Okay, we'll call case number 21-8040, Lennon versus City of Casper. Mr. Hambrick.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, counsel. When the United States Supreme Court ruled on this court's decision in Bond, it reiterated its instructions in excessive force cases that when defining clearly established law, not to be too general and to contour the laws so well that the reasonable officer would know that his or her conduct was unlawful or not, given the situation confronted. There are three clearly established laws that have come out of this court or the Supreme Court that are directly applicable to our case. The first of these is that when considering the reasonableness of an officer's conduct, the mentally ill or emotionally disturbed condition of a suspect must be considered, and it is unreasonable to aggressively confront, lethally or otherwise, an armed, mentally or emotionally disturbed individual without first obtaining additional information or by not approaching in a threatening manner.
So the question I have there, counsel, is did these officers know whether or not this victim was mentally ill or disturbed?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there's plenty of evidence to that. In our briefing,
there was plenty of evidence that other people saw him acting erratically. Did these officers, when they approached him, know what the others may have known?
Well, you have to take into consideration what dispatch told the officers, Your Honor. And we have the dispatch transcripts. You have the dispatch transcripts. The dispatch transcripts told the officers that the end of the first episode, there was a man swinging a crowbar out in the middle of the street in the middle of a snowstorm in the middle of the night. The second episode that was dispatched to the officers was a suspect fitting the same description, entering a convenience store with what appeared to be a sword, talking crazy, saying all kinds of weird stuff.
Was that in the dispatch? The talking crazy and saying weird stuff?
Yes, absolutely. Talking okay. Crazy.
We'll check that.
Saying all kinds of weird stuff. Who put what drinks that had the poison in them?
Right.
And he scared the clerk, left without taking anything, and that was it. That was the second dispatch call. So the officers were well aware of those. That's what they were responding to. And then, even when they get there, the mere fact that Douglas Oneyear didn't respond to any of the commands and just kept walking, I believe, on top of the dispatch notes, is another clear indication that there's something wrong with this guy. So, that being said, the Allen case, the Jannetty case, Hastings, Sevier, and even reiterated in your Bond and Sabalos decisions, clearly state that that is a clearly established law, that you cannot approach one of these kinds of people without first trying to obtain additional information.
What information were they supposed to obtain? Were they supposed to watch him from afar? Were they supposed to pull up but stay in their car? Were they supposed to get out and ask him some questions nicely to see what was going on? I mean, what were they supposed to do?
Well, the one thing that's clear that has to happen, Your Honor, and every officer is trained and knows that the three most important things you do when approaching a suspect are maintain a safe distance, time, and cover. And so those things have to happen. And in doing so, you can try to do any number of those things that you suggested, Your Honor. Which ones didn't they do? They didn't do any of them. That's the problem. The officers in this case, instead of trying to obtain more information, they identify, and this goes to the third rule, which is the officer's actions are unreasonable if their own reckless and deliberate conduct results in the need for the use of lethal force or escalates the danger. When Officer Slaugher identified the suspect, he, and you could tell this by watching the video, he breaks He tells dispatch, he radios back in, I'm going to be out with that guy. He continues to close the gap. He knows that this gentleman is headed directly for him, walking down the street, and he closes that gap by driving an additional 14 seconds before he stops his car, and then he flicks on his lights, and then it takes him 4 seconds from the time he gets out of his car, opening the door, getting out of his car, to get to the front of his car. He's still aggressing on this person who's coming right at him. And by the time that, within that 4 seconds, he pulls his gun and starts yelling commands at Douglas One Year. The law is clear, again, that the officers are unreasonable if their own deliberate conduct, and this is deliberate conduct on the part of the officer, it certainly wasn't accidental. He identified his suspect, and he continued closing that gap. And again, what that does is create a dangerous distance, time, and he didn't use the cover that he even had in his vehicle.
If we look at the video and we see that rather than the officers approaching the victim was approaching the officers. Well, that's a different picture, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor, because I think it's undisputed that the victim was walking in the direction of the officers. That's completely undisputed. The problem is the officers were closing that gap as well.
They were not withdrawing. We can't see that the officers first standing by the front wheel of his patrol car, and then as the victim approaches, he moves back and ends up at the back tire of his patrol car.
No, it's clear that he does that, Your Honor. But the problem is he's already closed that gap. He's already invaded the space and created an unsafe.
So the gap closing happened when he drove his car for that 18 seconds. Is that what you're looking at?
That and the fact that he gets out of his car and still advances on this oncoming person, the person he could clearly see is coming at him.
Okay.
And he closes that gap even more, creating an even more unsafe distance and time. And that, the Modine case, the Bella, the U.S. Daniels case, all of these are cited in the briefing. Those all, and this court in its Taylor versus Salt Lake case that was just decided back in October has a nice footnote that lists a bunch of these cases where this 10th Circuit has said it's an absolute clear law that if their own reckless and deliberate conduct results in the need for the use of lethal force or escalates that danger, that they have violated that.
So that's the danger creation theory?
That is the danger creation or escalation theory.
Okay. And has the Supreme Court opined on the validity of that theory?
U.S. versus Daniels. I'm not sure it's U.S. versus Daniels. It's the Daniels case. It's cited within our brief, and that is a United
States. And do we have two recent per curiam cases out of the Supreme Court that pretty much tell us we're not saying that that's law? In fact, we're saying in Servier, it's really dicta when they talked about danger creation.
Your Honor, your court, again, in the Taylor versus Salt Lake case, handled what the U.S. Supreme Court did in the reversal of Bond on the Sevier case. And I believe the other case you're referring to was talking about the Sevier case as well. The Sevier case, while and this court itself did it and I believe it's footnote 4 of the Taylor versus Salt Lake case that you guys decided back in October. It stated that while it's talking about Sevier being dicta, that does not overturn or reverse any of the cases that Sevier was relying on when they made that call. And all of those cases that Sevier relied on when your court again said that created that blanket rule that everybody cites Sevier now, when they created that, all of those precedent setting cases are still there and still exist.
All circuit cases though. We don't all have anything circuit from the Supreme Court that has blessed that theory, do we?
The Daniels case, Your Honor.
Okay.
And it's cited within the brief there, and I don't have that right in front of me.
Yeah, that's fine. We'll find it.
Okay. That's covering two of the laws, the clearly established laws that were already in place. You can't approach the mentally ill without first obtaining more information. And again, Judge Carson, how they do this it can be in a multitude of ways. Any of those situations where you suggested, the fact is they didn't do any of them. And that's the problem. That's the violation of that particular rule. And then the third one is that it is unreasonable to use lethal force against a short range weapon unless two things, unless the suspect has made aggressive movements with the weapon, or if not, whether they're within striking distance of the officer or another individual. And those cases to come out of the Tenth Circuit were the Tenorio case, the Walker case, the Zucco case. We've cited all of those. There's also a U.S. case, the Casella case, which is a newer case, again, reiterated within the striking distance rule.
So the Casella case was where an officer shot someone who was a potential threat to a third party.
Right.
Okay.
Right. It's the same thing. It's the immediate threat that the officers have to see is either to themselves or to a third party. And that gives them justification. But in order for it to reach the level of immediacy, this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have said those two things. Either there's got to be an aggressive movement by the weapon, which in this case there certainly wasn't, and it's undisputed that he never moved the weapon. And the second one is a disputed fact of whether or not he was within striking distance of the officers. The main point...
What is your evidence that he wasn't in striking distance?
The video, Your Honor. After, if you count, as we pointed out in the brief, if you count the number of steps that the officer takes to the dead body of Douglas Wynear after he drops, when you see from the photos and not just the video is deceiving. The video kind of looks like he's a lot closer than he was.
Were the photos presented to the district court?
Yes, Your Honor. They were in there. They're cited in our brief, and they were in the appendix as well.
So let me ask you this. Does it make a difference? So if you're looking at the video, if it were a standoff where if you were 15 feet away from me wielding a sword and I shot you, would that make a difference, do you think?
Yes.
To the situation where if I was standing there and you were advancing at a brisk walk toward me?
I'm glad.
I mean, doesn't the fact that your guy was closing the gap mean something here as far as your short-term weapon defense?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Your Honor, because in the Tenorio case and in the Zucco case, they addressed the Tenth Circuit addressed those issues and have said quite clearly that steps towards the officer is not an aggressive movement with the weapon. So no, that doesn't matter. Absolutely not. Plus the mere fact that they closed the gap as well, they're the ones that created this issue. Sure, this man was walking down the middle of the street, but it's not until they close the gap, they block his path, they stand in front of him and start yelling and pointing guns at him, that this situation turns deadly. It's their actions that do it. So while you have these specifically clearly established laws within the Tenth Circuit, and several of them have been reiterated by the United States Supreme Court, the problem in the lower court here was that the district court judge made rulings that there was no evidence of some of these things. For instance, that Douglas Wynear wasn't, there was no evidence that he was emotionally disturbed. There was no evidence that the officers created this condition. And while a finding of balancing evidence can be discretionary on the part of the court, a finding of no evidence can't be. A finding of no evidence is black and white. It either is or it isn't. And when viewing the evidence that I've stated here today and all of the evidence that's set forth in our briefs, the court needs to remember that this is a motion for summary judgment. And all of the evidence has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which is us. And the problem with saying that there is no evidence on certain of these things is if there is, as we believe we've proven, and in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, we certainly have, if there's a finding that there's no evidence, then that by definition tells this court that the lower court did not take into consideration the totality of the circumstances, because the totality of the circumstances has to include all of the evidence that's there in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You're out of time.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks for the argument, and we'll go to Mr. Marvel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, Brian Marvel, on behalf of Officer Schlager and Officer Myers in their individual capacity. I will notify the court that I'm going to try and limit my time to 9 minutes, so co-counsel will have time as well to address the panel. Thank you. Briefly, and I want to, because it was the last thing talked about, address this, the aspect of the summary judgment standard in viewing the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. That is true, but what was failed to mention was the fact that when you have video evidence, and that video evidence is clearly contradicts the position taken by the non-moving party, then it doesn't have to be considered, and that's what we have in this case. The evidence in this case rests on the dash cam video that has been presented to this court. And what I want to address specifically at this point in time is this idea that the officers, in responding to a call, acted recklessly or with deliberate conduct causing the situation. And if you'll forgive me, you know, I'll pose a few questions in regards to this. Was it reckless to respond to the initial call? That's what the officers were doing. The officers were responding to an aggravated assault. They were responding to a call in which an individual had threatened the store clerk with a sword and damaged property within the convenience store.
But also that this individual was known to be distraught somehow. I mean, isn't that a critical consideration here?
Well, Your Honor, and I think the district court addressed this. What you're asking, we're addressing this in 2020 hindsight. You also have to consider this. The initial call comes in at approximately 11:26. Within 3 minutes from that initial call, the officers have to travel down the road and they encounter Mr. One Year. So what that would suggest is within a 3 minute time span of traversing the roads, of looking for a suspect, and at the same time trying to traverse the roads in a way that they don't endanger the public, that we're asking officers to make a mental diagnosis.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Marvel. I don't think that the law would support any conclusion that officers are required in conducting their duties under such, you know, conditions to make a mental diagnosis. But dispatch did provide information about his mental state. Isn't that enough?
Well, I would say this, Your Honor, in relationship to abnormal behavior, I would say that going in and swinging a sword and threatening a store clerk is abnormal behavior by society standards in general. And simply because that there's a mention of crazy, and at that point in time, that is now going to be the standard by which any means there's someone saying that the individual is acting crazy or they're acting abnormal. At that point in time, we're now putting officers on notice that they have to respond in a different manner. And I simply don't believe that the law supports that. And especially when, given the fact, when you address the totality of the circumstances, and again, that's what it goes back to. If we're going to talk about that one isolated aspect in which they, so let's assume that they're dealing with someone who is emotionally unstable. There certainly is no evidence in this case that they're dealing with someone who has actually been reported as suicidal, and they're actually not having reports of someone who's in a mental distress or what the Ms. Lennon likes to refer to as an ACE event here, there's simply no evidence to support that. But let's assume that he's acting crazy. At the time that the officers respond, they encounter Mr. Oneyear in the middle of the road. Officer Slogger exits his vehicle, turns on his overhead lights, proceeds to the front of the vehicle, and states, "Hi, I'm Officer Slogger." At this point in time, he hasn't had his weapon drawn. He just approaches Mr. Oneyear. It's not until he perceives Mr. Oneyear coming at him with the sword that he draws his firearm and proceeds to backpedal to the rear of the vehicle. And this idea that the officers deliberately closed the gap simply isn't supported by the evidence. What they were doing was responding to a call. They stopped their vehicle when they encountered this individual. They attempted to contact the individual, and the individual proceeded to move forwards towards them. And at that point, the weapon is drawn and commands are given for him to drop the sword, commands which he disregards and continues his approach directly at Officer Slogger, while Officer Slogger is backpedaling to the rear of his vehicle. And I think context is very important in this case. As Mr. Oneyear is proceeding on Officer Slogger, he goes to the very back of his vehicle. At that point in time, where is he supposed to go? There's no additional cover. There's no additional place for him to go while Mr. Oneyear proceeds to approach him in a fast-paced manner. And at that point in time, we're split seconds in which we're asking Officer Slogger to make a determination about whether this guy is in some sort of emotional distress, and at the same time, backpedaling, giving commands, and doing everything that we've asked officers to do. There's simply no evidence in this case to support that Officer Slogger was acting reckless or that he did anything to deliberately incite this incident. The primary initiator in this, unfortunately, was the unwillingness of Mr. Oneyear to address and to drop the weapon or to comply with the commands in this case. The officers are in the middle of the street. There's nowhere for them to go other than where they went. And again, Mr. Oneyear is proceeding very directly towards Officer Slogger with a weapon. And the officers knew at the time that he had already threatened to use that weapon against the store clerk. So I think,
what do you think about your opposing counsel's notion that he says our case law says that if when you have a short range weapon, that the fact that the person wielding that weapon's approaching you or the officer doesn't matter? Or do you agree with that read of the case law?
No, I do not. And I think I think it the foul of kind of addressing the totality of the circumstances, which is what is required in these types of cases, and identifying some very specific rule. What's already contained within the analysis under both the Graham and the Larson factors is the manifest intent of the individual. And I think when you review the video in this case, the manifest intent is you have a suspect who is not complying, who is proceeding in a direct route towards the officer. And that is what is different in this case. And the case law is also very clear that the officers don't have to wait till they see, quote unquote, the glint of the steel in that. And so I believe that that's a mischaracterization, and it's far too defined of a general rule to say, well, anytime there's an edged weapon, that they can't present an imminent threat to the officer under the totality of circumstances, which is the analysis that needs to be conducted. I think in this case, he did present an imminent threat to the officers. And with that, I would like to turn it over to my co-counsel, unless there's any.
Let me make sure that Judges Briscoe and Rossman don't have any questions for you. Judge Briscoe?
I don't have any. Thank you.
Judge Rossman?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's move over to Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court and counsel, Hampton O'Neill on behalf of the city appellees. I apologize. We had some technical difficulties and got dropped off for almost 5 minutes of Mr. Hambrick's argument. And so I'm going to jump in a little uncertain as to everything that he covered. But I'd like to answer your question, Judge Carson, posed to Mr. Marvel. The cases Tenorio and Zukel and Walker that Mr. Hambrick cites as establishing some type of blanket rule that when the assailant is armed with a weapon of short-range lethality, that per se, as a matter of law, prevents the officers from using weapons or deadly force to deal with them. That's not what those cases say. That's not the law in the Tenth Circuit. Let's also remember that, as Mr. Marvel pointed out, it is the totality of the circumstances. There's no one cherry-picked fact that Mr. Hambrick can use to pull this case out of the Graham and Larson very fact-intensive analysis that must occur. This court in the city of or the estate of Taylor versus Salt Lake City case just recently decided, made this very interesting point, quoting the Scott case from the U.S. Supreme Court. The quote is, there is no easy to apply legal test for whether an officer's use of deadly force is excessive, and concluding that, quote, this is quoting from Scott, 550 U.S. at 383, we must still slosh our way through the fact-bound morass of reasonableness. And that is exactly what the court must do. There is no quick and easy way to step away from that analysis, whether Mr. Oneyear is carrying a fingernail clipper like the suspect was in Zukel, or a 38-inch sword like Mr. Oneyear was carrying in this case. The totality of the circumstances is what we all, us as counsel and you as the court, must engage in. And I think Judge Skavdal, in his usual fashion, was extraordinarily thorough about his analysis of the facts. For example, he covered in a very redundant fashion, didn't have to do this, but he ruled that there was no constitutional violation. And then he moved on to the second prong of qualified immunity and carried that burden through as well, even though he didn't have to do that. He did the exact same thing with regard to the municipal liability claim. He ruled as a matter of law that there was no constitutional violation, which could have ended the inquiry right there as to any municipal liability. But he wanted to be thorough, so he analyzed the alternative argument. Was there any deliberate indifference shown by appellant? And the answer, of course, is no, because Ms. Lennon has failed to prove any pattern of prior conduct that would allow her to get to that very high bar of deliberate indifference. And so I think that this cherry-picking focus by appellant on time or distance or whether Mr. Oneyear is armed with an edged weapon as opposed to a firearm, those aren't dispositive. And those are just other facts that the court and us as counsel must put into the formula that Graham and the estate of Larson provide. And I think once you do that, Your Honor, you'll find that there's an immense amount of facts which uphold the court's decision. And you'll also note that Judge Skavdal, I think this is very important, on pages 18 through 21 of his order, he points out Ms. Lennon's unsupported claims of disputed material facts and goes through that in careful detail. And when you get to the end of that analysis, you'll see that most, if not all, of Ms. Lennon's claims have no factual support in the record. They are conclusory statements. They're speculative statements. They're going back and also in addition to the lack of facts, the claim and the analysis that Ms. Lennon is engaging in is the Monday morning quarterbacking that the U.S. Supreme Court has said we just can't do in officer-involved shootings. The reasonableness standards has to be looked at from the perspective of the officer at the time in a tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving circumstance. And this business, I know I'm out of time, but I just want to make this one point. This business about whether the officers created the need to use deadly force, the test there in this court is that the officer's conduct must be deliberate or reckless, and it must unreasonably create the need to use deadly force. What Judge Skavdal so correctly noted about our fact circumstance here is Mr. One Year is in charge. He's behind the wheel. He's driving this event. It's his failure to heed multiple instructions to drop the sword, his continued aggressive, rapid advance, his failure to stop, his making a beeline for Officer Schlager. The focus should be on Mr. One Year every bit as much as it should be on Officer Schlager and Myers, who were responding to this emergency situation.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You're over time. I appreciate it. Let's see. Judge Briscoe, do you have any more questions?
No, I don't. Thank you.
Judge Rossman?
No, thank you.
We were 49 seconds over time with Mr. Hambrick. Okay. So I think the case is submitted. With no more questions from the panel, the case will be submitted and counsel will be excused. Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor.